Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm the host for Funny Stuff, half an hour of comedy, which airs every Friday night here on KCRW. And tonight is the night when I'll be presenting edited highlights of a conversation that I had down here at the station with John Cleese and Michael Palin. Unless you are new to this planet, you probably don't need to be told who they are, but just in case you are new to the planet, John Cleese and Michael Palin comprise 2/6 of Monty Python's Flying Circus, and they are also featured in a marvelous new film called A Fish Called Wanda, which is well worth your $6, and which we will be discussing later on in the interview. Just a little tip, if you've got stereo headphones, I recommend that you put them on for this interview, because these two guys are very funny, and they love each other very much, but they also interrupt each other very often, and some of the funniest stuff happens under one guy's breath while the other guy is talking on about something else, and there's a fairly pronounced stereo pan, so if you've got stereo headphones, you'll hear this a lot better. So without any further ado, let's get on with the interview, which began like this. John, in our last interview, you told us about a moment during the taping of the first Python episode when the two of you were standing backstage convinced that it was going to be very poorly received. Uh-huh. Can either of you recall the moment when you realized that you were in the midst of something that would be regarded as a classic?
About 3 minutes later. Well, I said to Michael, you realize that we may be about to do the first television show in the history of the BBC that is supposed to be a comedy and that is recorded to the sound of complete silence.
Yes, it did start like that.
But when did you realize that it was going to go on?
I'll tell you exactly. When we got halfway through the sketch with Terry Jones and Graham Chapman about the flying sheep, and the audience started giggling in a very strange way, and I thought, my God, it's going to work. Do you remember that?
No. I mean, I don't remember it ever. You see, I have this image of the first show having been received in almost complete silence. And I remember afterwards with the BBC bar where people go to after shows to sort of relax and wind down. And a lot of people were saying, lovely, love the show. I've just got to see somebody. I have to drink maybe next week. No, we can't run to dinner or anything like that. So people disappeared. And then I was telling someone about this recently. I said, well, I can check. I can look in my diaries, because I've kept a diary since about 1969. And I looked in my diary, and it actually contradicted everything. This image I was building up in my own mind about it being, you know, received extremely poorly and the first of a series of disasters. We all had a great time, and apparently I wrote that it was a terrific evening. And
had a lot of fun at the end of the evening, because we had to keep recording
Jean-Claude Zatapati,
the Concorde. He was explaining the Concorde in a very rapid, incomprehensible French.
Yes, we did have a lot of fun doing that.
And we did it about 6 times because they kept screwing it up technically. And remember, we did a take in which the moustache kept falling off because we were so sweaty by that. And we kept handing it backwards and forwards to each other.
Has anyone saved some of these outtakes? There must be some wonderful...
Le Trabchot, it was all the early days of Concorde.
I don't think anything was saved. It's quite a thought. I mean, you know the BBC, Alan Bennett did this incredible series for them called On the Margin, one of the great comedy classics, and the BBC wiped it.
There must have been some great outtakes.
Yeah. Well, there must have been some good stuff. I tell you what we've got, which we have never got around to doing. We have an entire LP of stuff we recorded for the other LPs, which is never actually... I should send Bob a copy. He could do it on his radio show.
Oh, we'd love that. Absolutely.
Python's garbage collection. I mean, they're really out of the bin.
The very worst of Monty Python.
Have you come to accept the fact that what you did in those shows and movies was worthy of the continued affection that they've received, or do you think that people are crazy to love them the way they do?
No, I think they're worthy of a great deal more affection, indeed adulation. I never feel they've been properly recognized.
Yes, the adulation
frankly, I'm pretty pissed off about it. What do you think, Mike?
He's very difficult to please. Yes, I could do a lot more adulation, you know.
It's fawning. It's out and
I
out
remember
fawning we're after.
The early days, 1974, when it really took off, we used to stay in the Essex House in New York, and we had 3 fans who would stand outside, only in good weather. You know, when it rained, they left.
That's
you know, and even the most inferior pop group, Son of the Trogs, would get 8 people or a carload of people. We had 3.
I remember the excitement, looking down, seeing all the fans outside of it, and sort of walking out, trying to pretend that I hadn't noticed them, and they ignored me.
They didn't notice
you. I said,
what's
going on? And they said, they're not for you. They're for the Sons of the Trogs.
We had to actually go up to the fans and tell them who we were. That was it.
And when we did the stage show, in the city centre of New York, 1976. We finished the show, and suddenly these security guys and these chauffeurs said, quick, quick, you know, get in the cars. They're going crazy out there. You see, they hustled us into all these limousines, and then we were in some strange underground park, and they threw the gates open, you know, and we suddenly, the cars tore through. And we looked round, and there were about 13 people there. Could we have your autograph? Yeah.
We're hired by the record company. Yeah.
Well, no, it was obviously the security people made their living out of pretending there were these hordes of people out there about to tear the shirts off our back. They had to pretend that they were there, even if they weren't.
Can you remember the most loony Python fan you ever met?
I mean, all of them were extremely loony. The craziest. I can remember quite early on when we first did a stage appearance in Coventry, which is sort of industrial heart of England. And we were doing one night at the Coventry Festival. It was midnight, and an entire front row of people in the gallery were in knotted handkerchiefs. Yeah. That's the first time I realized that things were likely to get out of control.
That was the Hollywood Bowl shows, and the audiences were much funnier than you guys.
Yeah, yes. Well,
they knew the material better.
Certainly did.
I mean, there was something extraordinary about going on to do these sketches, and you do the first line, Elio, I wish to register a complaint. Mm. Spontaneous demonstration, standing ovation, fireworks.
Yeah.
And then when it calmed down, you'd play the sketch to entirely to silence, and then at the end you'd get this terrific reception, and I didn't know what was going on, and I said to someone, what is happening? Don't they think we're funny anymore? And they said, go and watch the audience. And you stood in the wings, and you could see the lips going. They knew all the dialogue. So it was like a pop concert. It wasn't a comedy show anymore, because they knew the songs.
I think foreign Python fans are always quite interesting to watch. In Cannes, there were a lot of Icelandic sort of lap Python fans. That's very bizarre. Oh, you crazy people, you know? It's all funny.
I don't know,
funny ball.
The same sense of humor in Iceland.
Yeah, you know? We share your deadpan style of humor. Dead in the pan, you know? Oh, dear, glassy fell on my head.
Or the Swedes who come up to us and say, oh, we like your show so much, it makes us feel less sad.
Is there to be any 20th anniversary celebration for Python? You're coming up, is this October?
I heard somebody was trying
to... the same hospital.
Of 89.
They're going to transplant a whole new series of organs and try and give us another 10 years of show business.
Exactly, try and bring us to life again.
It's terrible. I mean, I haven't got any of my own hair left. This is all transplanted stuff here at the front.
But it's transplanted from you, I presume.
Well, it is transplanted. It's my own hair. It's just been moved around a bit.
Good. It's not Amy McDonald's.
And my knee doesn't work
anymore. It looks a little curlier than it should be.
A bit like Melitor
May's hair. No questions about the donor site, thank you very much. And all my teeth are capped. It's very sad, really. Two of them are in homes, as you know.
What, two of the
Pythons? Two of the Pythons. Yeah. Terry Jones is in a home. He has now totally lost control over
Gilliam
his physical
is actually not even in a home. This is the tragic thing. Gilliam strolls the streets.
That's right. He has two men in white coats walking about 4 feet behind him to stop him doing things. It's very expensive.
He has a little tin in front saying 44 million needed to complete this.
Aaron Monkhouse.
We don't talk very often.
Okay, there were two main camps in the Python team, the Cambridge side with Cleese and Chapman and the Oxford side with Palin and Jones. Is there a difference between the Oxford and the Cambridge senses of humor?
Great deal.
The Oxford are more sensitive, kinder, gentler, and with warmer. Slightly more, slight sort of, I think, I don't know,
woolly.
Odder. Mm-hmm. Are we odder?
Yeah. We're the Cambridge people like sharks, you know, we're sort of streamlined, vicious, efficient. Cold-hearted.
Slightly the smell of fish.
Slight smell of fish.
But I think it's to do with the climate. I mean, Cambridge is on this great flat fenland. It's very cold there and very bleak. And, you know, they're sort of rather like the Swedes. They get together and they reason with each other and do a lot of logical, you know, work and all this. And Oxford's in a valley and rather pleasant and people are slightly lazier and...
balmy. They all wear these short-sleeve pullovers, like Michael always wears, slightly fluffy jackets. And they're very nice, and they never do as well as they should. Except Michael's done all right. But Cambridge people always do much better than they deserve because they're so vicious and efficient.
Michael, you usually wrote with Terry Jones, and John, you wrote with Graham. Were these relationships totally faithful, or were there ever experiments in wife swapping?
I tried to initiate unfaithfulness at one point, and it was very strange how people wanted to revert, because Mickey and I wrote a couple of quite funny sketches.
Well, Minehead by-election, which we enjoyed
remember?
Writing. And
with Hilter standing as independent fascist. Yeah. What, did we write another
Mr.
one?
Mr. Bimler. Didn't we do something about the Vercottis offering protection to the army? I
That's
think it
right.
might have been one of those.
Remember the two guys from the mob who come and offer protection to the
sure.
army?
Yeah. Nice base you've got here.
You've got
That's right.
Pity to lose a division or two. Oh, sorry, Squire.
You won't get any,
off your desk.
Don't want any tanks getting done over, you know.
But then I wrote. We were fairly loyal. It was very much, you know. I mean, I felt if I was going to write at John's, you know, Terry ought to know about it. And that sort of thing. Otherwise, he'd find out in the Sun newspaper that we'd been seen together.
I wrote a sketch with Eric too, which I enjoyed about Sir George Head.
It was very good.
The guy who had double vision.
Oh, the mountaineering.
And we did that very briefly, and then for some reason it never happened again. There were people didn't want to upset the stability.
I wrote with Eric. I would like to say
what
I
did
wrote
you write
the awards, the BAFTA awards thing with Eric.
Oh yes. Yeah. I think we should have done it more.
Well, maybe someday you shall.
But I think the trouble was that the ones whose partner had gone off to be unfaithful sort of moped and got jealous, and everybody got embarrassed, and we were reverted to our original pairings.
Michael, what was it like to do the last series of six Python episodes without the tall one over there?
It was great for me, right. I tell you. It was one of the best times of my life.
It wasn't as good, obviously, and I think it proved that Python had to be six people, and as soon as you take away one part of it, you lost some of the impact. We lost, certainly there's no one to wear the tall person's costume.
Is there much Python material that we haven't seen over here?
Well, there's a fair amount.
Have you seen the German shows?
Hmm?
Do you
no.
know the two German shows we did?
They've never been seen.
Ah.
You've seen some of the best bits of them in the Hollywood Bowl video. Mm-hmm. If you remember, up on the screen, we used to project three or four bits we did from the German shows. The Philosopher's Football Match, Little Red Riding Hood, Silly Olympics. So that some people have seen some of it. But we did, two one-hour shows in Germany?
Yeah, they were kind of odd shows. But they were getting some lovely stuff done. It was
Philosopher's Football Match is a classic in its own way.
Yeah.
You know, the German philosophers and playing the Greeks. Do you remember it? Do you ever see it?
No.
It's very good.
No,
they don't really play football at all. They just sit and think for a very long time. And then Archimedes shouts Eureka, kicks off, and the ball goes down, and Socrates, I think, scores with a diving header. It's quite spectacular, and then they all go completely mad.
Who argues? Is it that Marx argues?
That's right.
De facto.
Yeah, that's right. It's somebody else, a phenomenologist, comes in and denies that the goal was real. Mm. It's a good piece.
Yeah. But also, there is a show we did from May Day once. I remember the BBC got us together. Do you remember?
Oh, very bizarre.
We did sort of take-offs of English customs and country dances, of which I think only fish-slapping dance survives now, but it must be around somewhere. The maypole dancing with people getting sort of strangled.
Yeah, it was the May the First show, which is the big socialist or Labour Day. Mm-hmm.
What was your proudest moment with Python? What would you put in the time capsule?
Apart from fish slapping dance.
Well, I'll tell you mine. What you think, Mickey? And that was mine was from a rehearsal and isn't on tape or film anyway. But I'd written this sketch with Graham Chapman, which was Cheese Shop. And every time I wrote about seven or eight lines, I'd say to Graham, "Is this really funny?" And he'd say, "It's very funny, just write it." You know, so we went on writing it for a bit. And then I'd say, "You really think this is funny?" And I had a complete crisis of confidence about six times. He just kept on saying, "It's funny, write it." And then we got to reading it out. And I was sort of fond of it, but I didn't really believe in it. And I chose very carefully the moment to read it out, which is very important when you're reading out Python material. You don't want to be too early or too late, you know, somewhere in the middle of the morning. And I started reading it, and Mickey here became hysterical. It was the happiest moment I ever had. He became totally hysterical. I think finished lying on the floor.
Remained hysterical since, whenever we've done the sketch.
Yeah, it's a good sketch.
I remember a great moment was actually, it took me by surprise. It was when we were doing the tour of Canada, and we got as far as Vancouver. And I was doing the lumberjack song. I don't want to be a hairdresser, I want to be a lumberjack. Floating down the mighty rivers of British Columbia with my best girl. And, of course, realizing you were in British Columbia, these words you'd said endlessly all over the world, and there was a roar, a huge roar. Two lines had never really got anything. And people threw bits of trees onto the stage. Mounties took off their clothes and ran naked through the auditorium. It was just a great moment, really, of shock.
And what was the worst moment?
The worst moment was doing the stage show in Leeds. When we had started the British tour with 6 radio microphones, by the time we got to Leeds, 4 of them were kaput. And the big group numbers consisted of us standing in these 2 very tight little groups of 3 talking into, you know, one particular microphone on one side of the stage and one on the other. And at a crucial moment, exactly as in Roxanne, we picked up a local minicab, you know, taxi station. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, in with the sketch was this, would you go and pick Mr. Arkwright up from 34 Barnes? It was a moment of such extraordinary lack of connection with the world. The audience were sort of looking around. There was no way you could fit this information in. And that was sort of funny and also slightly embarrassing.
I have 2 worst moments, both to do with the stage show, which was a fairly horrendous experience. One was when Graham completely forgot to appear for a sketch, and it was the sketch of Ken Shabby, where Ken Shabby is asking for her hand in marriage, and the father's supposed to come on and ask questions. This awful, grotty man asking things, and the father asks things like, you know, do you have any job? What's your job? Oh, clean out public lavatories. Are there any prospects? Oh, yeah, after 5 years, they give me a brush. That sort of humour, but it very much does depend on a feed man. And there, I saw Connie sitting there, and I arrived and I sat down, the lights came up, and I was coughing a bit, and there was no one else to join us. Graham just wasn't there. And after a long while, John appeared, looking rather amazed, slightly aggrieved, in the wrong outfit, and started to do some of the lines for us. Dear.
What was that?
That was on probably Southampton or Leeds. The other really awful time, which I was far worse because there was no fun to be had out of it, was doing the Eating Your Mother sketch in Regina, Saskatchewan. We did a Canadian tour.
Yeah.
And in places like Regina, I mean, they don't differentiate between Monty Python and the Royal Ballet or, you know, sort of the National Theatre. It's the big thing that you go to. And the front 2 rows are all full of the sort of local worthies, the mayor and all the council. And they sat stony-faced through Parrot sketch. So when it came on to Eating Your Mother, I've got my mother there. Well, what can you do with her? We can burn her, bury her, or dump her. I could see them about to, I think they'd, you know, sort of dry retching in the front row.
There was a wonderful line at the end of that. Do you remember that? It was the worst taste line. You know, when the guy finally says, all right, he says, all right, let's eat it then, you know, and the undertaker says, great, you know. All right, Charlie, he shouts down on the microphone. It's the 34 or something. The bloke says, no, wait a moment, I don't really. No, he said, I don't feel good about it. I don't think I should eat, mummy. And the undertaker says to him, look, Squire, he says, I'll tell you what, here's the deal. He said, let's eat her. And then, if you don't feel good about it afterwards, we'll dig a trench and you can throw up in it. The worst,
that's a bit of a test for any audience.
The BBC would only let you do that if you showed the audience getting up in revolt, right?
That was a deal the BBC did. They said the audience has got to invade the stage at that moment. It is a disgusting line.
It's wonderful.
I'm proud to say.
Without giving too much away, what is A Fish Called Wanda about?
Yeah, well, I think it's about this rather attractive, debonair, dashing, and, dare I say, sexy English barrister who finishes up with $20 million and Jamie Lee Curtis. But Jamie Lee Curtis seems to think it's about this rather sexy, manipulative girl who has 4 men in love with her and finishes up with the diamonds. And, well, Kevin Kline has some idea. It's what, Mickey?
He thinks it's about a sort of rather entertainingly aggressive psychopath with tendencies to learn Buddhism and eat sushi. And
who gets run over by a steamroller.
Generally sort
and Michael has some weapons. Ridiculous idea. It's about some animal rights activist.
Dashing. Yeah.
Dashing.
Dare I say, dashing. Dashing.
It's a dashing cast all around.
With a stammer who tries to kill an old woman and finishes up murdering all her dogs. There's a lot of disagreement, as you can see, but basically we say it's about murder, greed, lust, revenge, sex, and seafood.
And you can't get can't get anything like more than that in a movie nowadays.
More seafood, more fish, we claim, than any recent movie, including Jaws. That's by number, obviously, not by weight.
Was the fish sequence from The Meaning of Life your idea, and do I sense a recurring theme in your work?
Fish have recurred throughout my life, Bob. I had an early childhood experience with a fish, which meant a great deal to me.
He was born a fish, actually, weren't you, John? I think you're the only one of the group who was actually born a fish, is that right?
Well,
gilly,
there was an operation. I'm prepared to go that far. But
a human transplant grafted onto the fish.
I have a wonderful fish song that dates from 1972, meaning a life. So fish had been around for some time. I tell you who Wanda was. Wanda was a stripper at the Crazy Horse Saloon in Paris, which is the best strip joint in the world, where Terry Jones and I, and our respective wives,
went first met.
In 71, and this fantastic stripper came off called Wanda. I tried to get my first wife, Connie Booth, to call Cynthia Wanda, and then I tried to get Babs to call Camilla Wanda. So in the end, I had to call my main character Wanda. And Wanda in the movie is not only Jamie Lee Curtis, but also a fish that Mickey keeps in a tank, and because Mickey's in love with Jamie Lee Curtis, who's called Wanda, he calls his favourite fish Wanda. Now I'll shut up for a bit, and you talk to Michael.
John knows more about the film than I do. You know, I'm just nodding here. I'm nodding. I'm very happy to be
very supportive, associated
with this, even though I had to do some rather unpleasant things.
I was
going to
ask
film.
You about that. At one point, you do a scene with French fries up your nose, and is it a pear?
Yes, it's a pear in the mouth.
Was this an act of revenge for some long-ago transgression?
I don't know. I think he knows that I take pain well on screen. Don't argue and take the money and go. John said the first idea that came to him was the idea of having someone in a film who's part of a gang who has to give away vital information at a certain point and has a stammer. And I thought that was a very funny thing. And then the characters was built up around this. My father has a stammer, so I knew something about stammers. And I said to John, well, what happens with a stammer is the more pressure you put on someone, the worse it gets. Mm. It's not a sort of physiological thing which is just the same all the time. It's sort of mainly psychological. And it fitted in very well. So one had to put this character under quite a considerable amount of pressure to get him to do these things. And putting French fries up the nose with tomato ketchup attached was only just the part of it. Then there was the pear in the mouth. Then this awful man, Otto, ate all my lovely fish. Then I was lashed to a chair, which was then knocked over. And then John comes in. So, of course, I am under a certain amount of pressure at that point.
Well, this sort of abuse in the name of show business isn't new to you, because I understand you once had to eat 20 bananas and eat Tide shortly thereafter.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
What
yes.
was that?
Well, you see, you only get a lot of laughs from doing things that people would never, ever do themselves. But
what was 20 bananas? What was that?
When we did Cabaret at Oxford, we did a series of sketches, one of which was about banana eating. And I think it was just me interviewing someone who was a banana addict. And the interviewer gradually ended up eating more and more bananas. It wasn't awfully good. But at the end of it, I had eaten about 20 bananas, and I would have to regurgitate the bananas very, very quickly to go into another sketch, which involved doing a silly advert about some washing powder called Tide, which went on, where do we go? Tide geschumpf, Tide, am schüttel boom, Tide geschumpf. Ja, ja, sehr, sehr gut. And then I would eat a spoonful of Tide. And for some reason, we never got around to finding anything that would replace Tide and look like soap powder. So I did it with Tide every time.
So next to that, French fries.
So there's Tide and banana, which is, I'm going to start a restaurant soon, with banana and Tide souffle, but it's pretty horrible.
So next to that, French fries and a pear are a piece of cake for
you. Yeah, well, apart from not being able to breathe, they were fine.
The interesting thing about that scene was, you see, I thought, having a rather black sense of humor, I thought it was the funniest thing I've ever seen. Mm. I mean, when I saw the close-up of Mickey with the French fries up his nose and the pear in his mouth, I laughed as I have never laughed before. When we cut it together
too,
for the audience, all of us felt that.
Right.
But we kind of get it together for the audience, and it was too tough for them. They felt too sympathetic for Michael. Mm-hmm. And I said to them, you know, I mean, excuse me, this man has spent the previous hour trying to bump off an old woman. They said, yes, but she wasn't a very nice old woman.
But he's a stammer, and we feel sorry for him.
That's right. So the morality of it all is so addled.
Absolutely. Oh, the guy, that's his poor nostrils. Oh, those French fries. It didn't hurt that much, I have to be honest. Quite a pleasant
words.
Way
I mean, frankly,
yeah.
the Gestapo did not say, tell us the secrets or put French fries up your nostrils. I mean, it's not so terrible, you know.
This is all rather pleasant. I think I'll snort potato a little bit.
This is the first...
Mash habit.
Shut up, Michael. Let him answer a question.
Funny. Yes, carry on. Facial tissue.
This is the first film written by and starring John Cleese, and judging by the results, let's hope there'll be many more. You said that you...
Sorry, I have to listen to this all the time. I've heard his reviews. You know, he's been called some awful things. A great actor. He could be a great actor.
Funniest creature in the universe.
I have to live with him. I have to be in the same hotel as him. You can't try coming down the elevator with someone who's just been called the funniest person in the universe. He is grinning like a Cheshire ant.
Those things don't mean anything.
Why? That hailer you had yesterday.
What about David Denby's review for you in New York? Hey, that put a smile on your face, didn't it, little Mickey?
Oh, Dave and I are old friends.
Brother-faced.
Money has changed hands. Sorry, now please do
Denby
interrupt.
Says he does
please
something
do
with a stuttering no American actor could do. It's a lot of rubbish, but it made him feel very good.
You've said that you find acting a terrible bore.
Yeah. No, filmmaking, including acting.
Well, when the film is something that now you're so responsible for, is the process of making it any less tedious for you?
No, it becomes two things. It becomes more interesting because you've got so many things to think about, but more destructive of your life because of the incredible amounts of time it takes. I mean, Mickey's, when you did Missionary, it's 2 years of your life, basically, isn't it?
Yeah.
18 months, 2 years?
Yes. 2 years of my life and many more years of other people's.
Yeah.
Many more years of the audience's.
The trouble with filmmaking is it's obsessive, isn't it? You haven't got time for anything else, so you just put your life in the deep freezer and make a film, you know. And
I think
I'm
also
stop
that
a month.
As you know, it's inherited, I suppose, from pre-Python times when we used to do our own cabaret, and you'd run the whole thing, you'd write it, you'd perform it, you'd get all the props, and we're still fairly self-contained, and we still really only believe ourselves in the end that we know how to do it. So I mean, that just requires an awful lot of time because, as John says, every bit of the process you have to be part of, you know, whether it's the adverts or...
But I got to say, it was great working with Charlie Crichton, who started working in film before Hitler came to power.
I mean,
1932.
Did some of Hitler's early farces.
Yes, two or three of them,
the Nuremberg comedies. By Leni Riefenstahl. Oh, here they come.
Here they
600
come.
Million extras. Oh,
the Triumph of Seville mit Oliver Hardy.
Here's the famous hands-up joke.
The first job he ever did was working on an editing machine that was a silent one that had been adapted for sound. And he's also been directing since 1946, so he's been doing it for 42 years, and he does know a bit about it. The way he moves the action with the cameras, I think, is an object lesson. Mm-hmm. When you get people like that around you, you don't actually have to watch everything.
It is, and also, I mean, what I quite like about Charlie's direction is, I mean, a lot of filmmakers now, especially younger filmmakers, want to make some sort of statement, either with the camera or with the look of it or the lighting or the way they deal with the characters. Charlie just wants to get on with the film, and it does. I really, to his credit, that it rattles along at a great rate.
Somebody said, you know, well, what would the audience feel about Kevin Kline eating Michael's fish straight out of the tank? He said, well, I don't see what's wrong with that. Other fish do it to fish all the time.
Was it hard for you to do a nude scene, John?
No, because I'd done one 15 years before. I'd done a movie with hardly a stitch on through most of the movie with Connie Booth, you know, Romance with a Double Bass.
Right.
Nobody knows it in America.
The Chekhov thing.
Oh,
the
he'll peel off at the drop of a sixpence these days.
The funny thing is how many movies there are I've taken my clothes off in. I mean, I took them off for the sex lecture in Meaning of Life, do you remember? And then clockwise I'm running around in my underpants.
I love it, Bob. The millions of people all over the world, from Uruguay to the Faroe Islands, have seen your
another clean. If I could go and get Jamie Lee Curtis to play a lot of steamy love scenes with me, and I took my clothes off, I thought, there's a box office hit.
Certainly something to tell the friends later in the pub.
What's next from the two of you? Michael, you haven't had a chance to answer anything.
Well, I'm
fight
not,
though you may have been.
My forte is not quick thinking. I'm not particularly okay on the
very good at slow
spontaneous bon mot. I like a little more time. I personally would have preferred you to have sent me the questions on postcards several weeks in advance, and I could have mugged up
some nice to see
little witty riposts. But seeing as you have asked, I'm out of a job.
Bob, I've got to go now, actually.
What I shall be doing,
I've
just remembered.
It's about 25 to 6, so I've got to go and have a word with MGM, try
what
and find out who's
in charge
today. What I should
be doing is I'm doing a series of programs about people at my funeral.
Michael, are you coming?
Oh, I can hear John calling now.
Come
on, should
Mickey.
Be my riposte.
Come on, time you went now. Answering the question.
No, please. No.
Bye-bye, Bob. Nice to see you. What I intended to say.
Oh. And that's going to do it. That was our interview with John Cleese and Michael Palin. Special thanks go out to John and Michael, who are as nice as they are funny. And that's pretty nice. Special thanks also go out to Claudia and Joe at MGM for helping with the arrangements, and to Eric Myers and Bob Carlson, who helped with the engineering here at KCRW. And, see, I should also remind you that A Fish Called Wanda is currently playing around town, and that every time you go see a movie, you are casting a $6 ballot having to do with the future of motion pictures. So cast your ballot wisely, and I can't think of a more wise way of voting than to vote for A Fish Called Wanda. And you'll enjoy it as well. Certainly probably much more than most voting experiences that you've had. At any rate, let's see, next week's program is going to be Comic Relief 1, and then the following week we'll hear the second Comic Relief. This will be chopped up highlights of the Comic Relief performance with all sorts of comedians and things. And other than that, what else is there I can tell you? My name is Bob Claster. You can write to me, care of Funny Stuff, KCRW, 1900 Pico Boulevard, Santa Monica, California, 90405. And I thank you for listening. So until next week, don't forget to always keep that sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.